This is KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. You're tuned in to the Kenai Conversation. I'm Hunter Morrison. On this week's Kenai Conversation, we're joined by retired UAF geography professor and current Kenai Peninsula College geography professor, Roger Pearson, and retired Russian language and history teacher with the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, Gregory Weisenberg. Both study the history of Alaska place names. And Gregory and Roger, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first things first, I always like to begin these conversations with allowing our guests to introduce yourself. So yeah, I'll start with you, Roger. Introduce yourself. Tell me about your history here in Alaska.
Yes, I was a professor of geography at UAF for many years. And then I retired in 1998. And I was told when you retire, you should move south. I did, from Fairbanks to Kenai. And when I got to Kenai, I started looking at all the place names in the area, in the peninsula. And I got a real interest in why all these strange, quote-unquote, names were appearing. And so that became the basis for my interest in place names. And if I may just extend a little bit, I was also working with National Geographic Society in an education outreach program that it had for all 50 states. And try to build geography education. And we also, at the same time, just as I had retired, found a chance for a grant for working with Russian teachers. And the reason was that the Library of Congress hired a new historian for the Library of Congress. Usually historians were American history specialists. This one was a Russian history specialist, Ray Billington. He met with Senator Ted Stevens. And Stevens got very excited and said, could we do a program together? And they came up with the idea of Meeting of Frontiers, Russia and Alaska. And that happened in 2002, 2003, and we had 12 teachers from Russia and 12 Alaska teachers meet, and that became a two-week program that we had, and one of the teachers in that system was Gregory. So that started our Russian-American Alaska place names.
Perfect. And Gregory, yeah, introduce yourself. Tell me about your history here in Alaska.
Well, I will reintroduce myself. I'm Gregory Weisenberg. Back in the old country, which was the Soviet Union, I taught English. So I had my degree in English from a local college. And then in 1991, after a few school exchanges between the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District and Magadan schools, and Magadan was the hub of the Northern Far East, about 3.5 hours as the crow flies from Anchorage. In 1991-92 school year, for that year, I was invited as an itinerant instructor to teach Russian. The arrangement was for 1 year. At the end of the school year, instead of returning back to the old country, which didn't exist already because the Soviet Union ceased to exist at the end of 1991 during my first school year in Alaska. Anyway, in March of 1992, I was offered another contract and then another contract. And to cut the long story semi-short, after that, I got my green card. I became a citizen and stayed here to teaching Russian. I added teaching world history also and coaching too. And anyway, this is my short story, so to say.
Okay, gotcha. And, you know, I'm curious, what sort of formulated your interest in place names, Alaska place names?
Well, I want to say by accident, but probably it would be a little bit punny because actually, after I got my driver's license, which, of course, without any accidents, this is what triggered my interest in place name. And this is why, if you can see, I brought here an Alaska Atlas and Gazetteer.
And that is a large atlas.
Yes. And after I got my driver's license, that was quite an event, at least in my life, because back in the old country, I couldn't afford buying a car, and I never thought I would ever buy or drive a car. And here, at the age of 40, I learned how to drive. And my American friends, most of them teachers, decided to throw a surprise party for me and would bring gifts that were related to this event. That is right. And one of them is this Atlas, American Gazetteer. And after they left, I started thumbing through the Atlas, and my imagination took me to all the corners of Alaska. And so I thumbed through all the pages, and the more I thumbed through the pages, the more I had the sense of deja vu, because I saw Russian words there. Yes, they were transliterated. I might later comment on that, what it means. But for me, being a Russian speaker and interested, there were recognized by me, and I decided to test my knowledge of what those place names really meant. I decided to test it by asking my friends, and I started with our beloved feature, Redoubt. And when I asked them, hey guys, do you know with this enthusiasm, do you know what Redoubt means? They gave me this look and said, well, you can see it. I said, no. I mean, what it means. Again, it was a very interesting conversation. We spoke English, apparently. But do remember, I think it's George Bernard Shaw who said that about Great Britain and the United States being divided by a common language. And so I felt that we both spoke English. However, I couldn't get across my message. Finally, they understood what I meant when I told them, guys, these are all Russian words. Oh, we didn't know. We know where they are, those places. And that convinced me that it is a match made in heaven for a teacher who teaches Russian and could teach actual Alaskan kids through the place names.
Interesting, and we'll dive a bit more into the Russian names here shortly. Roger, I'm curious on your thoughts. You know, what sort of formulated your interest in you know, place names?
Well, during most of my time at UAF, my colleague Don Lynch was teaching the Alaska class, and I did other classes. But in the last few years before I retired, I started picking up on more of the Alaska stuff. And with a colleague of mine, Marge Hermans Osborne, we developed a Alaska and Maps Atlas. And so that really got my interest up, and started working more and more with Alaska place names. And that just continued on, especially after Gregory and I got together. I might just mention something here, since Gregory will not. Being a high school teacher does have its challenges, and students are going to find out if the teacher really knows anything, if they can pull any stunts on him. And one of his students needed to go on a trip hunting. It was hunting season. And Gregory came back, and student said, thank you for letting me have the break, sat down. And then I'll let Gregory explain the rest of the story.
Yeah, go for it.
Yes, that was, as I would probably say, my 1 minute of fame. Or the students probably thought I was a psychic reader, because I even remember the student's name, you know, who returned back from that hunting trip. His name was C.J. Horworth, a great student. And, well, as the protocol has it, of course, I approached him and said, do you have an excused absence? Of course, yes, Mr. Weisberg, don't worry. I went with my dad on a hunting trip. And I asked him, and where did you go? And Mr. Weisberg, are you a hunter? Ah, no, I said, I'm not. I don't hunt. So why would you care? I said, I'm just curious. I said, okay, I went to Nabesna. I looked at him and I said, I bet you and Dad hunted bighorn sheep or something. And everyone looked at me, and CJ looked at me, how do you know? And that was, you know, I think that was actually a defining moment, because they liked all my stories about place night. But how did I know? Easily. Nabesna is actually, if you change just the second letter, instead of Nabesna, you say Nebesna. It's from the word sky, high sky. Well, I figured out it was an elevated place somewhere ago, although I'm not a hunter. But anyway, that's what happened, and I think from there I got the enthusiasm, the attention of my students, which can be explained probably by the fact that they helped me with all the technology and PowerPoints, you know, because I'm not good at that, but they helped me. So I had tons of stories, but anyway.
Interesting.
This is the one.
Interesting. Now, Roger, I'm curious, you know, place names, they also have the study of place names is toponyms. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes.
Gotcha.
Greek. Topo, okay. Place, nem, names.
Perfect. You know, when people maybe look at a map and they see a place name, they might just think of it as a name next to a dot on a map. Is there more to place names than just that?
There's a lot. I like to think of it as hidden in plain sight. You go drive along like a tourist and you see this name, and it says Soldotna, or it says Seldovia. Okay, that's nice. But it doesn't really sink in, as Gregory pointed out, with readout. But actually, when you open up a dot on the map, everything sort of explodes. Because if you're going to understand a place and a name, you have to know a little bit about the geography. Where is it? What's around it? You have to know something about history. Seldovia has a history as a Russian community, and the economy of that town of Seldovia. I'll let Gregory just toss that one in.
Yeah, go for it.
As far as Seldovia is concerned, it's the same pattern. In other words, at least for the first few years, I kept surprising my students and my friends by asking these seemingly easy questions about the communities, what they meant. Like, as if we talk about Seldovia, actually, if we chop the last letters and to the root of it, which is, let's say, Seld, that is a Russian noun meaning herring. Of course, there is slight mispronunciation here, but again, don't forget, we're talking about transliteration. And this is very important, because the Russian names we deal with or we research, those are the Russian names transliterate. Transliteration is the process of converting a written text from one writing system, which was Russian, apparently, when it was Russian territory, to another writing system, which is English, aiming to represent the pronunciation of the original text in the new system. And sometimes there are discrepancies. Sometimes there are mispronunciation. After all, Russian language has 33 letters and English 26, with all my respect to the letter. But anyway, so this is how it works.
And I want to talk about Russian place names here in Alaska a bit more. I know that you're familiar with a Russian author who wrote a book on Alaska place names. Could you maybe tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. And this is a book that I would say that both Roger and I fell in love with. The author's name is Varshavsky, and the book was published in 1982. So, which means was published when the Soviet Union was still intact. And I would say this is the only comprehensive book on Russian place names in Alaska. The author did a great job. However, his book, I would say, is limited to telling very interesting stories, truthful, interesting stories. But there is no data. And when I use the word data, I will now pass the buck, because we have a professional scientist here. And he introduced me to the concept of how important data can be, even in researching place names. Because being a high school teacher, I was pretty complacent and happy with just sharing the exciting stories with my students. I didn't know that bringing in certain data opens up something different, which we can later also comment on. But I would like now to redirect this to Roger.
Yeah, Roger, go for it.
Okay. Well, one of the things that Gregory and I tried to do was to get a complete listing of Russian place names. In fact, we'll talk about this a little bit more later on. We also looked at Spanish place names and English place names, because those were three very distinctive languages coming to Alaska during the late 1700s, early 1800s. What happened with the Russian languages, when we got through with the transliteration part, was we found that from 1728, which is when Bering made his first voyage, he named one place, and that was St. Lawrence Island, until 1863 was the last new toponym, Russian toponym, that we had, but we can take it up to the end of the Russian period, 1867. During that time, there were about 360 transliterated Russian toponyms that still existed. Some names, of course, had disappeared or switched for one reason or another. But that we thought was the end of the line. And I was very happy with that. And Gregory said, why don't we take a look at Russian names on up to the present day? And I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. So off we went, and we looked for particular kinds of names that would give us a clue that it's Russian. For example, Russian River? Well, yes. And there were other names that were very strongly hinted that they were Russian, emphasized. We call these names honorific. So they give honor to anything that is Russian. Varshavsky's book, Gregory, could you read the title of that in English?
It can be translated as The Perpetuated Glory of Russia.
And from Varshavsky's perspective, that perpetuated glory stopped in 1867. Other than, of course, in case nobody noticed, there are, some over 80 different Russian Orthodox churches in Alaska. And we have a whole host of honorific place names. In fact, about 600. Now, wait, let's go back. Up to 1867, we had about 360 Russian place names. since 1867, 600. So not quite double, but amazingly close. So I think the perpetuated glory went far beyond what Vershovsky had in mind.
Interesting. Now, Gregory, I'm curious, you know, you moved here from the Soviet Union. When you first moved here, aside from a few of the Russian names that you mentioned, were there any that really stood out to you that maybe, just kind of stood out to you?
Sure. We've been discussing so far place names, that is, names on the map. But there are also Russian borrowings in Alaska vernacular. And that's why I brought here to the studio these two books. And one of them is How to Speak Alaskan. Another one is Alaska Dictionary. A funny story that happened even before I got my driver's license and before I got interested in researching place names happened when my American friends, it was during my first month here in Soldotna in 1991, we drove to Anchorage. They invited me. We drove together. And then we stopped. There is a point called Beluga Point, scenic view. And they told me, well, you see, we have belugas here, Grigory. My reaction was immediate because I felt that now my reaction was totally enthusiastic and gastronomical because I thought that I will be eating the prized black caviar. The thing is that beluga, the way you guys pronounce it here, stands for the sturgeon. Prized sturgeon from the Caspian Sea, apparently a fish. Now, a Russian word for the whale that they meant is beluga. I don't know if you can hear this difference in pronunciation, but this beluga, this how, like in home, maybe, house, beluga. So that is the whale. Now, the confusion is that actually both words are of Russian origin from the word belly, white, the white belly. But over time, maybe because it was more convenient for American speakers, for English speakers to pronounce it as beluga, they created, at least in my mind, in the mind of a native Russian speaker, a confusion. But as time progressed, I understood that I will see no caviar here. So, but I'm okay with that.
Interesting. Now, Roger, let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about some other place names here in Alaska. You know, as people are sort of coming up through Southeast Alaska up to South Central via boat or however they're getting here, they might notice, you know, Spanish names, British names, that sort of thing. Could you tell me, you know, why might that be?
Yes. In fact, our research, as I said, started with Bering in 1728. But that whole period from the 1700s, from after 1728, on up to the early 1800s, actually the late 1700s, focused on Russian, then Spanish, and then British. To give you a little time frame for this, the Spanish arrived in 1774. The first explorer there was Perez, and he was given instructions to just head north and look around, basically. When he got back home, which was along the Mexican coast, he was asked about what happened and what he discovered, and the Spanish were rather surprised. He didn't have an awful lot of very good notes on directions, you know, latitude and longitude. But he said, well, I wasn't given that charge, so I didn't bother. But he did get a lot of information, general information about places. For example, he sailed all the way up into what is today known as Dixon Entrance, and almost to 5440, the famous latitude line, 54 degrees, 40 minutes. That still is important in Alaska. So that started the Spanish, and they were there until 1792, and then they left because this was the waning period of the Spanish Empire, and they simply couldn't afford to stick around anymore. They stayed in mostly Southern California. Okay, we can understand that. The British came in overlapping that. Captain Cook was the first British sailor, and he came in 1776, left in 1778, and then about 15 years later, in comes Vancouver, 1793 to 1795, and he was gone. So that was very quick. The Russians hung on. But as you saw, they moved rather slowly. But still, those were the only countries that were really involved in Russian exploration, or in exploration that led to place names. So we have the oddity of, for example, the English. You would think, well, how do you tell? Well, here's a clue. Prince William Sound. Quick. Is there any American royalty? Well, not quite. So it had to be English. And the Spanish terms, Valdez, Cordova, how'd those names get in there? Well, that was the Spanish. I did a count on those. There were about 144 Spanish place names, and they had about 8 or so different explorers going on during their time period. And the British did it in 2 quick runs by Cook and Vancouver, and they came up with about the same number of place names, about 144. So they really made their mark in a fairly short period of time. The Russians took their time, going from 1728 to 1867.
And, you know, why have those names sort of stuck, the Spanish and the British names?
I don't have a good answer for that. Somehow, maybe it's just the sound of some of these that people don't bother to want to change, although some names have changed. For example, Kayak Island was named originally by Bering as Saint Elias.
Which sounds Svetoilia in Russian. Sounds like Svetoilia in Russian.
There you are. And that was just the Cape area, or the island area. But then in the between, there was a Spanish name. There was also a British name. And then a Russian name came back again, which was sort of a trade-off with the native name, because it looked like the island was shaped like a kayak. And so the Russian name won. We still have Kayak Island, the Russian native combo, I guess. So that way you start looking at these names, by the way, and that gets us into looking at the history of how these names change. Well, we're dealing with that today. Is it Mount McKinley or is it Denali? So that's one of these long-standing changes, and we see it internationally. Is a name has have names in Ukraine, for example, change from Russian to Ukrainian, and this just simply has gone on historically with name changes. Some names, however, just simply stick. I don't know if anybody that's particularly interested in getting rid of Seldovia or some English name. Prince William Sound. There we are. So we're comfortable with it. It's just a sound rather than the meaning. And that's one of the other things that we talked about just briefly about place names. You say the name, but we don't look into the geography, the history, or the language, the linguistics. there's just so much information in that one simple little dot on a map.
If you're just tuning in, we're joined by retired educators Roger Pearson and Gregory Weisenberg. Both study the history of Alaska place names. And, like, are there any, aside from Kayak Island, are there any names, whether they be English or Spanish names, you know, from that era that were named that really stand out to you? I know you mentioned Valdez, Cordova. Are there any names like that that really stand out, their history or their even their meaning?
Most of them tend to be of saints, maybe a ship or people. So that's going to tell you a little bit about maybe Spanish Catholicism or Spanish royal hierarchy. Some of them are descriptive. So you can get some sense of that if you, for Spanish students, they want to go through our, Gregory has done that, go through that list of 144 places with Spanish students, seeing how many they can figure out what their meaning is. And of course, that also happens with the Russian as well.
I would like to add to this that as far as the Russian place names are concerned, or the process of place naming, there are probably, we can single out four major tendencies in how the place naming occurred, Russian place naming. And the first one consists in the total change. For example, a good example will be the old capital of Russian America, New Archangel, or Novo Arkhangelsk, that actually was renamed into Sitka. Another tendency would be the Russian, the translation, exact translation of the Russian toponym into English. And a good example will be Resurrection Bay. It used to be Bukhta Voskresenia. After Alaska was sold, Bukhta Voskresenia was literally translated into English, and the English word for it is resurrection. Then we have, and I already mentioned this, we have the third tendency, transliteration. And we deal with these toponyms because they are the ones that survived, not lost in translation. Well, and the last one, of course, the toponyms that have a, as a descriptor, as an adjective, the word Russian. And there are quite a few of them here, which probably, I think, would draw the attention of any curious tourist. Even if they are not familiar with the history of Alaska, they will suspect that there is a Russian footprint here.
Interesting. Now, yes.
Sorry, go ahead. Some of this could be a little confusing as well. For example, I was thinking about Spanish names. Here's one for you, Boca de Cuadra. That definitely sounds Spanish. So obviously it was a name that was given by the Spaniards for a particular bay in southeast Alaska. No. It was given by that well-known Spaniard, George Vancouver. Oh, wait, he's British. Vancouver and Boca de Cuadra met. They enjoyed each other's company. The Spaniard had better wine on his ship than Vancouver did. So later on, Vancouver, in honor of his good Spanish friend, came up with the name Boca de Cuadra. So you will find, I think, about six or seven toponyms by Vancouver that were either Spanish or Russian. And Gregory, you could tell us about a Russian term named by Vancouver.
Yes, very interesting, which in my opinion, I might be wrong, just proves how actually personal the place naming can become if people know each other. Exactly in the same token, Lieutenant Whitby, if I'm pronouncing correctly, who was on Vancouver's ship, I believe, he named, actually it is Tony Knowles Park in Anchorage, Cape Voronsov, Point Voronsov. Vorontsov was the Russian ambassador in the royal court of Great Britain. However, he was very pro-British during the Napoleonic Wars. And, of course, Whitby wanted to honor him for that. And that's how he bestowed Vorontsov's name here in Alaska and put it on the map of Alaska. Another one in the panhandle of Alaska, Bem's Canal. Bem was the governor, the then governor of Kamchatka. Well, Vancouver stopped by Kamchatka to get some fresh water or some other stuff, and my understanding that Bem offered him a Russian hospitality, and so after he returned, went back to his voyage, Vancouver decided to name after him a canal, you know. So, and I like these stories because in some way they show that in spite of the policies of governments, people remain people, and they're thankful.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to learn about all of these interesting connections to places that I've heard of but never really given it much thought past the place name. You know, Roger, I do have I kind of want to go back to some of the Spanish and British explorers. You know, aside from place names, what importance did these sort of explorations have, you know, like what is their importance in regards to today?
Well, maybe historically it might be an interesting way to look at this. For example, one of the problems that the Spanish had, and the Russians, was scurvy. It was a nasty problem because ships simply didn't have access to the best foods, nor did they really have much knowledge of nutrition. The British sort of took the lead in that, and they experimented with things like sauerkraut, and also making some kind of beer. And as a result, the British had a real success. Recall, the Spanish started their voyages from the Pacific coast of Mexico and went north. Cook and Vancouver started off in Britain, much longer distance, and they managed to survive and do fairly well. Vancouver came up with something called spruce beer. He found that the spruce needles, which made into beer, actually had some vitamin C content. My colleague and I decided to check that out, and just for the fun of it, good geography science project. One spring, we got together with our students and we clipped fresh spruce needles. And we took those, and we had a colleague who was a former colonel in the U.S. Army Cavalry, and he knew something about brewing beer. So we got the needles and he helped make the brew. When we got it, we took it over to the chemistry department at UAF and said, could you check the vitamin C content of this? And it turned out that it made the bottom line for what is the amount of vitamin C needed to prevent scurvy. So that was a hugely important finding. So looking for things that would improve vitamin C content, and that changed shipping explorers in a very major way.
Huh, interesting. Now, you know, aside from Captain Cook and some of the other explorers that we've touched on, Vancouver, are there any others, either Spanish or British, that really stand out during this era?
Well, let's start with Bering, and I'll let Gregory pick up on that one.
Yes, well, Bering is the symbol, at least in Russia, Russians' mind, of discovery of Alaska. because, and I will be briefly touching that because there is so much to talk about Bering. Well, to begin with, we have quite a few place names. We have a Bering Strait in Soldatna, but we, of course, have Bering Sea. We have Bering Glacier. We have Bering Strait. We have even a Bering Plaza in Anchorage. Anyway, but Bering, to begin with, was the first one, the first Russian. When I say Russian, I use this term loosely because he was from Denmark. In fact, I'm glad, Roger, you redirected this to me because I'm so fascinated with his achievements, with his two expeditions, that 2 years ago I took a trip to Denmark and went to Horsen, his hometown, and visited the church where he was baptized. But going back, Bering went twice towards Alaska, let's put it this way. First time, it was the first Kamchatka expedition from 1725 till 1730. And he was the one who discovered, so to say, that there was a body of water between Eurasia and North America, later called after him, Bering Strait. Then his second Kamchatka expedition, that was when he actually discovered for Russians Alaska. So Bering, of course, stands out, in my opinion. He's my favorite explorer. Of course, other people followed in his.
If I could add a little bit to that, that's our normal way of talking about Bering, but we're skipping a rather important point. Bering started his expedition in St. Petersburg, and he was directed by the Russian government to go by land, not by water. Consequently, he went across Siberia, first European Russia and then Siberia, and through some very rugged terrain, and the Siberian winters are even worse than what we have for our coldest areas. So Bering survived that, both the trip from St. Petersburg all the way to Alaska, and then from Alaska all the way back to St. Petersburg again, twice. If you want to compare that with, say, Lewis and Clark, they only had to go by land. And the weather wasn't quite as severe as what Bering found on his voyages. So I think we've understated the enormity of what Bering actually accomplished.
Interesting. Okay. Now, I want to kind of switch gears here a little bit, and something we haven't talked about was Alaska Native place names. Are those a part of your studies as well?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. We have decided not to cover that. And in my mind, it's a historical geography issue. There's a lot of very, very important work going on throughout Alaska for resurrecting and rebuilding Alaska Native place names. One of my colleagues, Jim Carey, has worked with the Tenaina in particular, and there are others, you know, working elsewhere in Alaska to try and build a really very good language base for the native languages. If we think of it as a mapping geographer, one who looks at what we call geography information systems, GIS, think about everything in layers. One map layer might be the landscape, the mountains, the rivers, the vegetation, and so on. Another layer might be Alaska Native names, those we see building back to where they were, which would be, you know, hundreds and hundreds of names, thousands. So we're building that base. Then the next layer up would be the first explorers, which would be the Russians, the Spanish, and the British. And now we get into the modern-day language place names, after 1867. So each one of these layers is very important, and it's a matter of beginning to look down at this three-dimensional system of place names, to focus down on the place names, which go back from time immemorial with Alaska Native names up to the very short period of the explorers to the modern period, which is still building.
Interesting. And I know that you said you don't really study Alaska Native place names, but would you say that some of those names might have been lost because of some European or lost to European or more Russian names?
Yes. And of course, we see that happening just from some of the examples we gave, for example, like Kayak Island. There were other Spanish names that also disappeared, and Russian names that have disappeared, just through that process of time and how names were selected. So there's been some good research done on this, for example, going through all of the old logs from the Spanish explorers, and you find these treasures of place names that we had no idea happened to be Spanish, and today they're perhaps English or something else. So that's not that uncommon. Well, I better leave it at that point.
Got it. Now, you know, I like you mentioned, you don't really study Alaska Native place names, but I'm curious on your thoughts. You know, what might be the importance of preserving some of these names?
It's all very important. And it did remind me of one thing. Gregory found that there are Russian Native names. Now, where do you put the emphasis? And that gets very tricky. So we are going to have to consult Native language experts who can look at the name and see if they can ferret out the Russian part versus the Native part. And there are a number of those, and I think they're very important. So it's a whole different category that's sort of not part of our study, but it's really critical.
A good example of it will be the name Barabara, which is a subterranean thought house, which is not actually per se a Russian word, but I believe a Kamchatka native word.
Interesting. Now, you know, we are kind of coming close to the end of our conversation here, you know, and I'm sure there's a lot of other threads we can pull in and topics that we could touch on. I guess I'll throw the question to you first, Gregory. You know, what would you say is, I guess, the importance of knowing the history of Alaska place names?
Well, I'll probably conclude with what I started with. For me, the study of Alaska place names appealed to me as a teacher because it offered my students a new model of thinking, which I would call a triune model or an interdisciplinary one based on an alliance of geography, history, and linguistics. And when it is relevant to Alaska history, to where the students live, then this becomes personal. And when history becomes personal, from my 37-year experience of teaching, students have all the reasons to get interested in it.
And would you say that that maybe learning the history of Alaska names in your classes maybe helped your students remember them better, learn more efficiently?
It's better to ask them, but I think so. I think it did help them. But again, that is probably that question for objectivity should be addressed to them.
Gotcha. And Roger, same question to you. I'm curious, you know, what would you say is the importance of knowing the history of Alaska place names?
I'm going to slip off a little bit to the side on that one. One of the things that I mentioned early on was noticing all these place names. As we drive around, and I include ourselves as well as tourists, unless we actually stop and look at the landscape, we miss stuff. I call it hidden in plain sight. You drive by Redoubt Street in Soldotna all the time. Does that really ring a bell for people? or you go down to Seldovia, as I mentioned. So stopping and looking at these different names, even American names, gives us cause to have a second look at things. And if I may, I'd just like to add one other thing here. We have some fantastic resources for place names. U.S. Board on Geographic Names was created in 1890, and because they needed some kind of listing of place names for maps, and we were moving into Conestoga wagons onto trains and eventually in a car, so we needed to have something that we could have a good map that tell us where places are. The first Dictionary of Alaska Place Names was going to be published in 1900, about the same time as the census. Unfortunately, Board on Geographic Names didn't have enough money. They started this project in 1892, but the first edition they came out with was in 1902, and it was about 20 pages. That's rather short. A much, much more extensive publication came out in 1906, which really provided a foundation for the next great edition, which came out in 1967, and it's been updated slightly to latest printing is 1971, and that was by Donald Orth. And that book is still available. In fact, the price can't be beat. If you go to the Alaska State Geological Service, you will look at their materials. You will find a Dictionary of Alaska Place Names by Orth, free. So it's worth downloading if you're interested at all in place names.
Interesting. And now I kind of want to talk a little bit more about your work and your studies. You know, could you tell me about if there's any projects you're working on at the moment related to toponyms that you'd like to talk about?
One of the things we really want to do is to build a very solid source for place names, historical place names, like the Alaska Gazetteer. We want to have ours, all of the Spanish names dating to that time period that we can find. Same for the Russian, same for the English. Every now and then we get carried away and think, oh, we're done. And then, of course, somebody gets the last laugh because we find a new term. So we want to have this complete list of terms developed and available to everyone, which will have all the locations, who the explorers were involved in this, what the story is, a brief story behind each of the names. So it's much like the Dictionary of Alaska Place Names, but it's more condensed and focused just on toponyms per se for those three exploration periods.
And would that be like an online resource? Could you
yes.
tell me a little bit more?
Hopefully it will be an online resource, and I'd love to have these available as maps, so you get a lot of interactive work. So there's a lot more to go on this, and that helps keeps us young.
Cool. And Gregory, I'm kind of curious in regards to maybe some of your more current studies on toponyms and place names. Could you tell me about something that you might be working on or something that's, you know, in the future?
Well, it's an ongoing process, you know, but definitely I'm curious about new names, and especially how the motivation behind naming them, because actually the hardest thing is to figure out what motivated the explorers to name, let's say, a place Cape Kovrishka. Cape Kovrishka, it's a point of land, it's northwest coast of Unalaska, Aleutian Islands. You know, about, I don't remember, about 20 years ago probably, when I first came across this name, it elicited a chortle and gave me a reason to think that those first Russian explorers must have had a sweet tooth if the cape's square shape reminded them of Mother Russia's favorite dessert, honey cake. I remember I ran this by my son Anton, and he was though skeptical because he dismissed my theory as he believed that the shape of that cape was very general and could relate to almost anything when you look at the map. And he was also right because the word kovrishka, it turns out, is also the diminutive form of the old Russian word kovriga, which refers to the end piece of a typically round loaf of a traditional Russian bread, specifically the first and last slices. So to my knowledge in English, the most widely used term is heel, right? The bread heel. So the heel is the very first and last slice of bread. So it was my son's descent that made me look up the word kovrishka this time on the map of Russia. When I reached Lake Baikal, a name in its northwestern part caught my eye. Cape Kovrishka on Baikal. Another one. So a coincidence, well, it has been known, which brings this to a special type of toponyms. It has been known that the first Russian explorers and merchants in Alaska, including the famous Grigory Shelikhov, hailed from that particular area of Siberia. Then, could it have been the same nostalgia, let's say, that prompted the English colonists to name their New World communities, New York, New Hampshire? Anyway, so these are the so-called shift toponyms that were brought from the mother country, and there are quite a few examples of the shift toponyms on the map of Alaska. They're very interesting. In fact, if we talk about relatively recent history, if we look at the names of the villages of old believers, like Nikolaevsk, Voznesenka, Razdolna, I bet that those are the names you can find on the map of Russia, too. They are the shift toponyms.
Interesting. You know, we could probably sit here and talk about place names for hours. This is a very interesting conversation. But before we close, is there any parting thoughts that either of you would like to share?
I just like the idea of taking a second look as you drive along the road. We talked about tourists to start with. I'll end my comment with tourists. This is a pretty exciting place, this whole landscape of Alaska. And look at the mountains, look at the rivers, look at the lakes. Yeah, it's all great. But look at those names also, because you start looking at names, that's your second look. And it really builds your curiosity.
I would like to say, I would like to add that, you know, when people are asked what are the signs of the Russians' presence in Alaska, the first thing they mention, of course, churches, the distinct architecture, Russian Orthodox churches. But I think that toponyms are also a sign of Russia's presence. Of course, in the eyes of the beholder, if the person speaks Russian, he can easily recognize it.
And that is all for this episode of the Kenai Conversation. A special thank you to Roger Pearson and Gregory Weisenberg for joining us. You can hear the Kenai Conversation every week on Wednesday at 10 a.m. and Saturday at 5 p.m. here on KDLL, or you could find it on our website, kdll.org. I'm Hunter Morrison. Thanks for tuning in.